findanastrologer.com, the best astrologer database online. Search astrologers' bios, events in your area, featured articles, book reviews, blogs, MP3 downloads, video downloads, resources, and interviews. findanastrologer.com. Illuminate your journey.
Hi, I'm Tony Howard, the founder of findanastrologer.com. In this podcast, I'll be speaking with Richard Tarnas, the author of Cosmos and Psyche and The Passion of the Western Mind. Rick is the founding director of the Philosophy, Cosmology, and Consciousness program at the California Institute of Integral Studies. Today, I'll be speaking with Rick about the impact of his work, as well as his thoughts about astrology's rightful place in the cultural dialogue. Soon I'll be posting part two of this interview, in which Rick will take us through an astrological analysis of cosmic genius by way of looking at a popular and very funny interview with comic Louis C.K., which first aired on the Conan O'Brien show and then went viral on YouTube. Watch for that interview coming soon, but for now, enjoy part one of this interview with one of the most revelatory astrological thinkers of our era. So, Richard, welcome to NORWAC. Glad to have you here.
Thank you.
When I read Cosmos and Psyche, my impression was that this book was going to have a really profound effect on our culture and on the world. And you're in the university yourself, and I'm wondering if you've been able to track its effect, at least in that realm, in that arena.
Well, it represents such a paradigm shift for the mainstream academic world. I certainly didn't expect to take that world by storm with a single book of evidence that basically, when you see that astrology, or when we recognize that astrology is essentially the gold standard of superstition in our culture, there's no way that a single work with even as much evidence carefully presented as is in Cosmos and Psyche, that's not going to turn the ship around. But probably not a day goes by when I don't get, letters, emails, and feedback from readers, many of whom are in, different parts of higher education, and sometimes, professors, but very often, more often, say, graduate students and so forth. So my sense is that that book, I wrote it for the long term, and I see it as having a potential effect over in future years. And it's had some influence now, but it's up against such a, we've had several hundred years in which the idea that there could be any meaningful correspondence between the patterns of the planets in the heavens and the patterns of human experience, that idea is so off the radar screen and really completely counterintuitive to what the mainstream academic world would assume to be true, that a book like this isn't going to make much of a dent to begin with. Now, my first book, The Passion of the Western Mind, is used in hundreds of universities in the United States, but also in other countries. I stopped counting after 100, so I don't really know how many it's being used in, but in philosophy departments or history of Western civilization courses or seminaries and so forth. And that's a history of Western thought that I deliberately, while astrology plays a role in it in terms of being part of that history, it is not an astrological work, and I don't interweave what's going on in the sky with what planetary alignments are coinciding with Descartes' philosophical breakthrough or Galileo turning his telescope to the heavens. But then I do all that in the next book, Cosmos and Psyche. So I use the first book, Passion of the Western Mind, as a kind of Trojan horse that establish some credibility in the academic world so that people who like that book or use it, etc., are more likely to then take seriously this, more revolutionary idea that astrology has validity. And then they could go on to read Cosmos and Psyche.
Great. Well, thanks for the contribution, for sure.
You know, in the book, you look at squares and you look at the whole cycle. You know, from square to opposition to closing square.
Starting always at the conjunctions and oppositions. I put the major focus on.
Right, and I was wondering if you noticed anything in your research a difference between the opening square and the closing square.
This is an issue that Dane Rudjar particularly developed, a sense for the unfolding cycle and the differing roles that the two squares play. And Rob Hand did kind of translated that into a systematic transit cookbook, the book Planets in Transit. In practice, when I look at the there is a definite difference between the squares and compared with the conjunctions and oppositions of these big, we're talking, by the way, about, if you're talking about cosmos and psyche, we're talking about the big historical cycles, the world transits where everybody is involved, not just personal transits. And if we look at, for example, the difference between a Uranus-Pluto conjunction, say, of the 1960 to 72 period, with the typical Uranus-Pluto combination of this mass empowerment of Promethean energies and liberating revolutionary phenomena, turmoil, etc. So that's a conjunction. Then you look at an opposition, such as happened during the French of the same planets, French Revolutionary Epoch, 1787 to 1798. You have the exact same phenomena, the exact same quality of mass empowerment of the Promethean impulse. And at the same time, one is a conjunction, the other is opposition. And it's not really, there's much more that's similar about those two periods, having the same archetypal dynamic informing each of them. There's much more similar than there is different. And the squares seem to have a little bit, they tend to have a smaller orb compared with the conjunctions and the oppositions. The squares tend to have a little more instability to them and a tendency to, they're a little, I think, harder to assimilate. This is also true for personal transits and so forth. But at the same time, they can be unusually dynamic. There's something especially likely to bring about a concrete event out of a square. Now the question about opening and closing squares, I do not personally, on the basis of the historical research, have a decisive sense of the difference, even though my sense is that Rudjar's right. I mean, I see them as being much more similar than different. My sense is that Rudjar's right, that the closing square is just going to have more of a it's on its way to the end of the cycle, while the opening square is the first pancake, so to speak, after the initial batter was made, to use a very homely example, during the conjunction. And there's something to be, I theoretically think that is the case, that there is a difference between them. But historically, what I mainly notice is at the level analysis I've done in research is that you see this the same archetypal energies, that complex of energies, tends to express itself very visibly in concrete events under each of the quadrature aspects, the conjunction, the square, the opposition, and then the closing square. Each of them, and there, while there is a continuing relationship between what happens under each of those alignments and what happened during the preceding one, I don't, at this point, I can't point to, well, this is definitely an example of a closing square compared with an opening square. I think that research will be done and people are going to be able to see it, but at the level that I've done, I'm more tracking the this more macro similarity of the same archetypal themes coming up under each of those big alignments.
Do you see history as a story that you could describe as progressively forward moving?
it certainly has a progressive aspect, and there's no question in my mind that, for example, we see a moral evolution from the point of view of, let's say, racism or patriarchal sexism, say, as recently as, say, the 1950s and early 60s, compared with now in the United States. A real a moral evolution has happened, also in relationship to gay rights, for example. It's been a you know, clear deepening of the moral consciousness in these fundamental areas of life. And even like on a broader scale, you could say, a broader historical scale, there's no question that like mass entertainment for the late Roman Empire was watching murderous, torturous circuses taking place in the vast amphitheater locations during the holidays of the Roman Empire, of which there are many, and they were watching absolutely horrific things, which we don't have to spell out here. And that was daily, you know, people would come, bring their families, they'd be eating, etc. Now people go to football games, and that's a development. I mean, the football games can be brutal, but they're not being, the gladiators aren't being torn limb from limb, the Christians aren't being eaten up by lions, and so for the entertainment of the population. There's been a really deep moral evolution. That being said, there's lots of regressions and losses that take place in the course of history. There, I mean, clearly other peoples, other cultures, other eras had a larger, say, eco-spiritual sensitivity, let's say, than the typical modern industrial mode of consciousness that would go in and see what would have been a sacred mountain in one era and society turned into just a mining project, or a sacred forest turned into, you know, clear-cutting ancient redwoods and so forth. There's been real losses, and earlier eras had more profound spiritual, let's say, access to the spiritual world, while the later Western and modern self has tended to be much more developed in its thinking function, but has lost that kind of, what Rudolf Steiner would call that kind of primal clairvoyance, that spiritual discernment or that discernment of the spiritual realm that was more accessible in earlier eras. And a person like Plato or Plotinus was able to describe metaphysical experiences that the philosopher in the typical academic setting today, it has lost touch with. So sometimes there is I think it's important for us to keep in mind that there are losses and gains in every epoch, and that can be spiritual, it can be ecological. It would be, as I say, there's been great social advances, moral advances, and there's also it's been since the 60s that much of the worst corporate, industrial, technological devastation of the earth has taken place, at the same time that this marvelous advance has been made in the rights of women, of minorities, and so forth.
Where do you see astrology's rightful place in culture? You know, it's currently on the fringe, but, you know, if we listen to how people speak about astrology, you know, people who haven't experienced astrology might say, do you believe in astrology? And other folks may ask, how do you prove astrology? And so the question arises, is it a science? Is it an art? Is it religion? I mean, where do you see its proper place in that culture?
Well, I can easily imagine that a culture that more or less became as enlightened as, say, large numbers of people are who, live in the Bay Area or come to astrological or international transpersonal conferences and so forth, Jungian institutes and things like that. If our civilization were to be transformed to the point where those sensibilities and those communities of learning were more central to the culture, there's no question that we would have a more self-aware and cosmically grounded and spiritually oriented civilization, and those would all be great pluses. On the other hand, I have to hasten to mention that astrology, as it is still currently practiced, has all sorts of deficiencies and shadow consequences. Many astrologers do concretely predictive, deterministic kinds of statements and interpretations that can be wounding for the client to hear. There is often a lot of kind of rules of interpretation that have been handed down in an unthinking and unexamined way that are suggest that they may be kind of ad hoc rules that are not really grounded in careful examination of the evidence. So there are major areas of improvement that are waiting to happen within the astrological community, and bridges also need to be built between the astrological community and the non-astrological intelligent public that will require not just the education of that public, but it'll also require a greater skill and self-awareness and care and rigor on the part of the astrological community. So in a sense, I think astrology is still in almost like an adolescent phase, at least at this time in its of history. It's in that phase, not perhaps quite ready for, at least as an overall phenomenon. I mean, there are individual astrologers who are doing work of such high quality and are so able to articulate things in a way that's accessible to the educated non-astrological public that they're ready to go. But the astrological community generally is still, I think, working within constraints that deter it from being embraced by the mainstream culture. So I want to, on the one hand, affirm an eventual rightful place of astrology properly evolved to be playing a central role in cultural life and intellectual life. I mean, it's one of the most powerful tools we have for understanding history, for understanding the human psyche. As Stan Grof says, it's a Rosetta Stone of the human psyche. It's it's extraordinarily useful in understanding works of art, films, looking at the actors' charts, at the directors, at the where the planets are at the time that the film comes out and audiences are viewing it and so forth. I can't think of any other frame of reference that can be as satisfyingly illuminating of culture, psychology, history, and philosophy and so forth as astrology can be. So it can seem ridiculous that given something that's that illuminating, that powerful and intellectual tool, that it would be so scorned. On the other hand, there's very good historical reasons for why it has been marginalized, and having to do with the natural evolution of the in the course of the modern the Enlightenment and the autonomous modern self, it in some sense had to negate astrology in order to have a more robust sense of its autonomy. And as part of the whole objectifying of the universe that took place with the scientific revolution. But And there's also very good reasons why astrology hasn't been quite ready for prime time to come back into the center of culture. But I think it will happen and should happen eventually, but not any time in the next couple of weeks or anything.
Right. Well, you know, one thing I think about that type of analysis where you're looking back at a cultural event that unfolds, or for instance, tracking changes in music over time, it's a really powerful tool to use astrology. And yet, I also wonder what it's for when you do that. It makes me think of literary criticism, right? So some folks criticize literary criticism. I've always loved literary criticism. I think it's really beautiful to look back at someone's work and analyze it. And a lot of times, you know, the criticism itself becomes a work of art. And yet you could also say, well, but what's that for, you know?
Yeah.
I don't know if there's an answer to that or what, but I wonder what you think about that.
Well, let's leave aside the literary criticism thing, because that would be a whole other issue. And there's profound literary criticism, and then there's literary criticism that does nothing but deconstruct and even destroy the appreciation of a given work of art, of a great work of art even. But in terms of what, say, our archetypal astrological understanding of the patterns of history can provide is, for example, had the world been better aware of the shadow potential of the Saturn opposite Pluto during the 2001 to 2004 period, with that tendency to draw boundaries that are very rigid between a good and evil, like to see evil out there and good here and on your side, and then the tendency towards war, towards preemptive destructive operations, and the misguided reaction by the Cheney administration after 9/11, for example, both 9/11 and the Iraq War and Abu Ghraib and Guantanamo and so forth are all reflective of that Saturn-Pluto opposition. And had there been more knowledge of the Saturn-Pluto archetypal complex, how it's come through in history before, there would have been a greater awareness of the way in which the collective psyche could get possessed by a shadow expression of that energy and get into this kind of rigid othering and scapegoating and objectifying and splitting, that even the use of terror in the supposed higher cause of fighting terror, all those things are such typical characteristics of the shadow side of the Saturn-Pluto complex. If there'd been more self-awareness, it would have had very practical consequences. And that's true also in our individual lives, to know better what forces might be at work at a certain time so that we can act with greater consciousness, greater autonomy.
Right, so it becomes about choices that you can make in the moment because you have that knowledge.
Yes. And it's also just aesthetically interesting and historically interesting to understand, like, well, why didn't the French Revolution happen 5 years earlier? You know, all the conditions were there, let's say, you know, or why is there so many revolutions happening at once, in 1848 or the Arab Spring in 2011 with, you know, once you start seeing what else is happening, the Uranus-Pluto alignment or the Jupiter-Uranus conjunction that combined with that during the first months of 2011, those are, it provides a real explanatory frame of reference for understanding otherwise inexplicable historical convergences of synchronistic phenomena.
And I'm thinking also that, if nothing else, it also provides a sense of meaning and a connection with meaning and with that idea that you bring up in your book that the primal world is ensouled, and that alone is worth a lot, I think.
Absolutely. I mean, that's There's something healing to recognize that we are embedded in a larger ensouled cosmos, that there are deeper purposes and meanings unfolding through human history than just human constructs and selfish ambitions and so forth. One gets a sense of that we're participating in something much more magnificent.
Findinastrologer.com. Illuminate your journey.